Welcome to Oncology Today, Diagnosis and Management of Interstitial Lung Disease in Patients Receiving Anti-Cancer Therapy. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with pulmonologist Dr. Charles Powell from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding presentation with Dr. Powell's slides. To begin, I asked him to chat about how he initially got involved in this area.
It was about 7 or 8 years ago that I wrote a review in Journal of Clinical Oncology summarizing the experience that was accumulating with regards to drug-related pneumonitis as it related to checkpoint inhibitors, which were becoming more frequently adopted around that period of time. And then shortly thereafter, I was asked to participate in an effort to review and adjudicate cases of interstitial lung disease that were observed in trials of a new class of compounds, antibody drug conjugates. And the early experience was that the drug was showing efficacy, yet there were patients who were exhibiting interstitial lung disease, and there were fatalities associated with interstitial lung disease in those who were treated with trastuzumab deruxtecan at that time. So it was determined it would be important to establish an independent panel to adjudicate these cases, since ILD was identified as an adverse event of special interest. And so I was asked to join this effort and to chair this effort, which was a multidisciplinary adjudication panel comprised of pulmonologists, radiologists, and oncologists from the U.S. and Japan, which was fitting because the trials and the company spanned both the United States and Japan. And so starting in 2017, I've been participating and leading that adjudication effort, from which we've learned a lot about interstitial lung disease associated with trastuzumab deruxtecan and now other antibody drug conjugates, and have been working to transmit our learnings to the sponsor and to study investigators and to patients so that we can do better in terms of early identification, do better in terms of treatment and mitigating the risk of interstitial lung disease. That's how I got to where I am today with regards to this talk, this presentation.
That is so interesting. You know, I have to share with you, I was mentioning the fact that, you know, once the pandemic started, one of the things we started doing was set up sessions with me and general medical oncologists and community-based practice. And of course, we've had a lot of cases of people getting TDXD. There are a lot of questions about it, et cetera. But a couple of weeks ago, I was one of the docs was presenting a case, and I don't know, we got into the subject about TDXD. And she goes, well, I had this patient who developed interstitial pneumonitis. It was a terrible case. The patient actually died. And the bottom line was they thought it was from palbociclib, which really shocked me. So, I mean, I guess that was the thing that came across that I first started to hear about TDXE, as you said, that made it different, was their fatalities. But, I mean, do you see fatalities in other drug-related pneumonitis? And, like, is that – I don't think her patient even had previous comorbidities.
Yeah, so there are a couple of – so, yes, fatality can occur with any drug that causes interstitial lung disease. Really what is happening is that the lung is demonstrating a injury in response to the exposure. And if the exposure continues and the injury continues, then it can increase in severity and can become irreversible and cause death regardless of the drug. Now, some drugs may do it a little bit more quickly than others, so there may be a shortened window of opportunity to intervene, and some drugs just may have a higher incidence of pneumonitis, therefore a higher incidence of grade 4 and 5 pneumonitis. So those are factors that contribute to the severity, but any drug, amiodarone or methotrexate, just those are more the canonical drugs that are associated with interstitial lung disease, they also can cause death. So certainly it's important to be highly aware that these drugs can cause death. And I think appropriately, the sponsors and the regulatory agencies were appropriately cognizant of, about the potential significance of this, but I think we've learned over time that heightened education and awareness can impact the incidence of grade 4 and 5. And as the new trials get reported out, the incidence of grade 4 and 5 pneumonitis is much lower than what had been reported earlier in the experience.
Right. And I'm really looking forward to hearing about that. Actually, that general medical oncologist was saying one thing that she didn't understand was that she had gotten the word, which I think is true, that if you see grade 2 pneumonitis with TDXD, that you don't use TDXD anymore, unlike other drug-related pneumonitis where patients can be rechallenged. I guess we'll get into the whole history of how that whole thing evolved. But again, from sort of a broad macro perspective, is that the case that, you know, you often rechallenge patients who have, let's say, grade 2 pneumonitis, but, you know, really right now at this point, you don't do that with TDXD?
For other drugs, when patients have a grade 2 pneumonitis that respond completely to steroids so that the imaging abnormalities either resolve or are completely stable and the symptoms are gone, it is possible and is commonly performed to rechallenge the patients. And that's especially crucial in the setting of advanced cancer, where there are not other options for these patients who are in these clinical trials because they failed all the other available therapies. So yes, that is the setting. When the trials were initiated for TDXD, understanding that there were fatalities early on, there was a very conservative management plan introduced into all the clinical protocols. And that conservative management plan called for cessation of drug for subjects who had grade 2 pneumonitis. And I think that was certainly conservative and probably prudent, but it had some consequences. And amongst the potential consequences was a delay in the diagnosis and treatment of patients with interstitial lung disease because of the understanding by the study team that if they did recognize and treat ILD, then that meant the patient would no longer be able to be treated with that agent, despite the efficacy that was demonstrated in many patients. So that, I think, likely, although we'll never be able to confirm it, but likely contributed to a delay in the recognition and treatment of patients who had grade 2 pneumonitis and likely also then led to the progression of the severity and the fatalities that were more common early on, such that now there are opportunities to retreat patients who have pneumonitis that responds to steroids. Typically, these are asymptomatic patients. So asymptomatic patients with pneumonitis who get steroids, if that pneumonitis resolves within 48 days or so, then those patients are eligible to be considered for rechallenge with drug. I have to say we don't have the full experience recorded to date on the results of what happens when we rechallenge with TDXD, but that's an important area that is under current investigation. And I think it's helpful for patients and helpful for the real world setting for us to better understand that.
You mentioned, you know, checkpoint inhibitor pneumonitis, and then you talked about your experience with ADCs. From a basic, you know, you're walking down the hall making rounds with people without slide type thing. How do you compare your vision of the pathophysiology in pneumonitis related to, let's say, a checkpoint inhibitor compared to, for example, you know, ADC or chemo?
The pathophysiology, I believe, is different between the pneumonitis associated with a checkpoint inhibitor versus the pneumonitis associated with an ADC, mainly because the business end of ADC is a systemic chemotherapeutic agent with direct toxicity, whereas, of course, for the checkpoint inhibitors, the pathophysiology of the lung injury almost certainly is due to alterations in the immune environment. So there are differences in the pathophysiology of, in terms of the causation and mechanisms of the lung injury. But once the lung injury occurs, there probably are not a lot of differences in terms of the response of the lung to the injury that happened. And so And I would say that the experience is probably similar, and that patients who receive checkpoint inhibitors with earlier recognition than when the drug was held and there were opportunities to treat those patients with corticosteroids as appropriate, it moved from being something that was quite worrisome in the beginning to something that became quite manageable, so that oncologists and other physicians are very comfortable with managing patients with checkpoint inhibitors and understanding that there may be a pneumonitis that occurs, and very comfortable with the treatment. Early on in the checkpoint inhibitor saga, we were doing a lot of more invasive testing to better understand the lung injury that we were observing, whether it was an infection or whether it was drug-related pneumonitis. And now that's very rarely performed in the setting of checkpoint inhibitors because we're quite comfortable with what it looks like and how to treat it. And I assume over time that it's likely that there'll be a similar degree of comfort with the understanding of the incidence of drug-related pneumonitis associated with ADCs and comfort with the recognition and the treatment of pneumonitis related to ADCs. The main difference that I think stands out is that the incidence of pneumonitis is higher in ADC treatment than it was or is for checkpoint inhibitor pneumonitis. So it's more common.
Right. And I guess another thing would be, you know, just again, at a more macro level, you know, I know you have your interest in lung cancer. And I know there was a time that, you know, checkpoint inhibitors were coming on board, and then COVID came in and that became a consideration when people who had acute pulmonary problems and lung cancer on top of it, et cetera. But, then the bottom line, a lot of times the bottom line was, you know, just kind of looking at what the patient's pulmonary status was and dealing with it symptomatically. And that kind of leads me also to the question of the clinical presentation and the distribution. So, for example, you're kind of saying that, you know, once you get pneumonitis, well, you know, there's a similarity. But in terms of the actual clinical evolution of it, is there anything typical? Is it usually bilateral? Any, you know, particular parts of the lung involved, anything characteristic of drug-related pneumonitis?
Well, drug-related pneumonitis, regardless of the offending agent that causes it, can present with one of several different patterns in the lung. And similar patterns are observed in other causes of interstitial lung disease, other causes meaning causes other than drug, and those patterns are well characterized. The most common pattern is the pattern that is described as organizing pneumonia. That's the most common pattern that we see in drug-related pneumonitis, although it's not the only one. And that there typically will be multifocal areas of ground glass nodular opacities with a central solid area where there's almost a reverse halo type of appearance there. And that is a very common appearance. It's usually more than one focus. It can be in both lungs. And so that's an important finding that is quite characteristic of an organizing pneumonia that can be related to a drug. Of course, depending upon its association with the administration of the drug. I'd say also the symptoms can be really myriad. Some patients have quite extensive findings on a CT scan, yet minimal of no symptoms. And some patients may have relatively minimal findings on a CT scan and impressive symptoms. So much of it really also pertains to the state of the patient and the state of their lungs before treatment. And there's a, you know, suggestion that as patients have more lung disease to start with, then they also have a higher propensity for both developing a pneumonitis and for developing symptoms if they should develop a pneumonitis.
As you deal with docs who are not pulmonologists, particularly medical oncologists, any, I'm not going to say errors, but let's say myths or misperceptions or things that maybe they don't remember from med school or about how they approach patients with acute pulmonary problems, how they approach patients with suspected drug-related pneumonitis, how they approach patients who are getting TDXD. I hear people talking about pulmonary function tests, et cetera. Any sort of things that are out there that you think maybe you might want to comment on?
I think the most important aspects to keep in mind are intense vigilance, because if unrecognized and if untreated, what can be considered to be a manageable and treatable toxicity from ADCs, that being drug-related pneumonitis, can become quite severe and fatal if we're not appropriately vigilant and not appropriately taking steps to mitigate progression. I think that's the number one key for all to keep in mind. We have to have a heightened awareness for evidence of early onset of interstitial lung disease. And that early onset can be detected through change in patient symptoms. The most common symptom we would think about would be shortness of breath and doing activities that previously didn't cause shortness of breath. Doing other tests may be helpful, but tests that we might think about, pulmonary function tests and oxygen saturation monitoring, those would be abnormal later on. And as the disease progressed, the earliest changes that we see would be the shortness of breath with exertion and a decrease in oximetry readings with exercise, not at rest. And we would see, if we did a pulmonary function test, the earliest change we would expect to see would be a change in the diffusion capacity, representing the impact on gas transfer. That would be much earlier than seeing a change in lung volumes or forced vital capacity. So to me, the emphasis is on focusing on the earlier identification, because that has the best opportunity to avoid progression of severity by simple steps, which can include holding the drug and or steroids. Hopefully, when the patients are still asymptomatic, so there's an opportunity to retreat should it resolve.
Where does imaging fit in? The one thing I have heard people, for example, related to TDXD talking about is looking at the CAT scan for, you know, early signs of interstitial pneumonitis. Is that a part of the diagnostic or screening approach?
So all of what we've learned thus far from the ADC experience as it pertains to TDXD and the other compounds in the adjudication process comes from the evaluation of every single chest CT scan that is performed in the context of the clinical trial. And typically they're performed certainly at baseline, and that every two or three cycles there'll be another CT of the chest. And oftentimes the pneumonitis event is first detected in an asymptomatic patient by review of those CT scans that are done in the context of a clinical trial. It is, CT is much more sensitive than chest x-ray. Chest x-ray is not sufficient for monitoring for the development of interstitial lung disease, nor for monitoring the progression of interstitial lung disease. It requires a chest CT scan with appropriate thin cuts. Now, what we're talking about are scans that are within the clinical protocols for these clinical trials, but now the drug has received approval for several indications, and the drug is available in the marketplace for patients whose illnesses are appropriate for treatment. So there's still, of course, a role for imaging of the chest in these patients, particularly for monitoring the response to therapy. And that schedule should be adequate for detecting interstitial lung disease should it occur. So right now, there are no recommendations for additional CT scans to be performed for screening for the development of pneumonitis. However, if there are signs or symptoms that may suggest pneumonitis, then if a recent chest CT had not been performed, then it would be prudent to do so at that time.
But just to be clear, if the patient had bone mets or didn't have an indication to do a CT of the chest, you're saying that you wait until the patient has some kind of symptoms before doing any kind of imaging. You wouldn't do preventive CT just for the purpose of early diagnosis of ILD, let's say with TDXD?
So within the clinical trial setting, chest imaging was routinely performed as prescribed in the clinical protocol every 2 to 3 cycles. Now that the drug is available for use by our oncology colleagues in the community setting, then these same considerations in the clinical trial protocol may or may not apply or be appropriate for specific patients. But I would say that given that the indications for use at this point in time are for patients with metastatic disease of the breast and lung, there is an indication in almost all, if not all, of these cases for disease response assessment that would include CT evaluation of the chest, where there's going to be need for further guidance would be in the case that there is approval of antibody drug conjugates for disease settings that may not involve disease of the chest, local disease, for example, if should that occur. Then really it would be important to have the data in hand to provide guidance as to whether or not there may be a role for routine surveillance using chest imaging in those settings. And I have to really say at this point in time, we don't have the information to provide that type of guidance at this point in time. I think we'll be able to gain it and gather it and provide it before these drugs are disseminated for uses other than the approvals that are present now. I think we also may want to take in consideration other strategies to identify the early onset of interstitial lung disease that go above and beyond chest CT imaging.
You just mentioned if a patient is, quote, symptomatic, then they need dedicated chest CT. But then the question is, what defines a patient being symptomatic? Somebody who calls up to say, I'm short of breath, or somebody who's doing a remote exercise thing with you all who gets a little hypoxic when they walk up a flight of stairs. So you're going to tell me that that's going to get ironed out and there's going to be consensus and statements and stuff like that. But meanwhile, docs want to know what to do. What about sort of stressing the patient? There's a nurse practitioner at Mass General in oncology who tells me this thing that she does. She puts a pulse ox on the patient, has them walk upstairs and all this other stuff. Not so much related to ILD, but that's just part of her thing, so to speak. Any kinds of strategies like that of any value in, you know, patients on drugs related that, you know, are associated with ILD?
Yeah, I love that approach. And so there's quite a bit of interest now in extending to patients the ability to have access to clinicians from their home with remote monitoring tools, for example, that would allow for the potential for earlier diagnosis of ILD should it occur. So those remote monitoring systems can include regular distribution of questionnaires, so it can pick up on some of those earliest symptoms that we mentioned earlier, particularly dyspnea or shortness of breath with activities that previously did not cause that. Oximetry with exercise as another physiological vital sign measurement that may be of use. Changes in pulse with activity can also be a sign suggestive of a physiological change that may be indicative of an adverse event such as pneumonitis. And I think there is utility to implementation of those types of approaches because then we can really fill in the gaps in terms of the contact we have with patients, not just relying upon their visit to the clinic every 3 weeks or so, but we actually can have continuous contact with the patient through some of these remote tools So there's an opportunity for earlier identification and earlier intervention. So I think there's a lot of promise in that approach.
You know, I guess the other thing on the other side is in a lot of these agents that are being used that, you know, not just TDXD, but, you know, so many other agents that this issue's come up with, you know, we don't necessarily know the exact amount they need to benefit. Like for TDXD, maybe they don't need as many cycles as they're getting, or maybe you could stop it after a while. So I don't know whether maybe in the future, unless we can come up with something maybe, you know, sort of like what you see with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, where you get treated and then you're done, or so many other hematologic cancers, maybe, you know, we can sort of meld this all together. I don't know.
Yeah. That's another key question. So now some of these trials that began in 2017, 2019, have patients that have been enrolled for 2 years and change. And we know from some of the experience gathered to date that pneumonitis, should it occur, typically occurs in the first year. Almost 90% of the cases occur in the first year. However, there are examples of patients in which it occurs later. And then the interesting question coming to the point you raised was, if the drug needs to be stopped because of the pneumonitis, is the response durable or is it not? And we don't have data to answer that definitively, but that would be key for understanding about what the impact would be should the drug need to be stopped.
You were talking about EGFR. And first of all, the osimertinib thing, we worked with Ross Camage like 2 months ago. I didn't even think to ask him about it. I didn't know about that. And I really wonder whether oncologists, I have not heard about this transient, you know, opacity thing. But anyhow, that's another issue. But I wanted to ask, though, about EGFR, about osimertinib, but also about one specific scenario. And I don't know whether this has come up at your institution, which is the patient who's had a recent checkpoint inhibitor. So a common scenario would be they might get, let's say, durvalumab after chemo radiation, and then maybe 2 months after finishing the durvalumab, they relapse and they've got an EGFR mutation, and maybe they even knew about that ahead of time. But then what we're hearing is if you give something like osimertinib or, you know, their other EGFR inhibitors, when an IO has been on board, you have a, quote, very high incidence of pneumonitis. So first of all, is that true? What's the risk? And also, docs want to know, how long do they need to wait?
Okay. These are really good questions. And I'll answer your question directly, of course, and then I'll tell you about some of the lessons that we're learning as it pertains to that scenario in combination with the antibody-drug conjugate. So second part first. It's not clear necessarily that prior exposure to a checkpoint inhibitor would increase the risk of interstitial lung disease from another agent such as an EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's not clear. I have not seen strong data demonstrating that. However, if a patient did develop drug-related pneumonitis after exposure to a checkpoint inhibitor, then that would be a potential indicator of potential host susceptibility to developing lung injury upon response to a drug. And I would then expect there to be a potential higher incidence of drug-related pneumonitis with treatment with another drug that can similarly injure the lung. So then really the difference is whether or not the patient developed a interstitial lung disease with the first agent or not. And if they did, I think the risk would be different, higher, of course, with a second agent coming on later than if the patient totally tolerated the first. So if we get new data that show a different experience, it'd be really important to dig into that in detail, and that may change my perspective. But that's what I would think at this point in time. As far as it pertains to the antibody drug conjugate story, one is, as I mentioned, there was a examination to review potential risk factors for development of ILD after trastuzumab deruxtecan administration done with a Cox regression and multivariate analysis. And amongst the variables that were examined were prior use of checkpoint inhibitors and prior radiation. Neither turned out to be a significant risk factor for the subsequent development of ILD after treatment with trastuzumab deruxtecan. Small numbers, yes. Perhaps using larger cohorts, perhaps doing the analysis more appropriately in the randomized trials for which data is becoming available for the patients treated with trastuzumab deruxtecan, we may get a different result, but that's what we learned thus far. I also say that there are ongoing clinical trials with antibody drug conjugates where patients are treated in combination with checkpoint inhibitors. And so from those trials, we hope to learn a lot about what the incidence is in terms of drug-related ILD, but we don't have anything to report at this time.
So we could spend a whole hour just on this ESMO paper, but a couple of things. I love the forest plot. A couple of things I wanted to ask, and you broke out Japanese and non-Japanese, and you were commenting in general, and in that forest plot, you see a much higher incidence in Japanese patients. So if you see, is that geographic or environmental? So are Asian patients, for example, in the United States at higher risk of ILD?
Ah, I love that question. I love that question because we ask that in other lung diseases, lung cancer. We ask that question too, given the higher incidence of lung cancer, specifically lung adenocarcinoma in Asians, specifically Asian non-smokers. And so really the question is whether there are genetic polymorphisms that may be different in Asian populations that make them more susceptible to lung injury, of which lung cancer is an extreme example where the response is proliferation, as opposed to interstitial lung disease, where the response to the lung to injury is inflammation. And so we don't know the answer. And the suspicion is that it's not purely environmental, and that there is some genetic, constitutional genetic difference that may be associated with susceptibility to lung injury upon exposure to these drugs. But we don't know for sure.
Well, actually, now that I look at it, it says country. So I guess the non-Japanese country actually includes Asian patients who've migrated, right?
True.
But I guess you don't have enough there. Do you have enough there that you can even look at it? Probably not. Yeah. So anyhow, to be continued. But again, the other thing too in these forest plots, and you again have commented a number of times, comorbidities, hypoxia, is that increased incidence, or because they have comorbidities, diminished pulmonary function, you kind of pick it up more readily?
I think it can be both. I lean more towards the latter, and that in patients who have significant comorbidities, there'll be a smaller threshold for them to tolerate lung injury before they manifest symptoms. So I think it's more of the latter. However, I can't rule out a contribution of an impact of comorbid disease on increasing the risk. And that comes from the experience now where in looking at asymptomatic individuals who have asymptomatic detection of subtle lung interstitial changes, that phenomenon is called interstitial lung abnormality. Those patients have an increased risk of death over time from any cause and an increased risk of drug-related pneumonitis, likely suggesting, again, an increased susceptibility in those individuals to develop a lung injury or a systemic inflammatory response. So I think it's a combination, but perhaps more emphasis on the earlier detection of symptoms in people who already have compromised lung physiology and function.
Any comments on bispecifics? Of course, bispecifics are so exciting in hematologic oncology. They're more immune-based. But we are seeing bispecifics starting to come into solid tumors. And in lung cancer, we have one, amivantanib, which is a bispecific about EGFR and MET that's used in it's been used in EGFR as well as exon 20, but approved in exon 20. That also, I think, is on the list of pneumonitis. Anything specific about the type of pneumonitis? I mean, the fact that it's a bispecific, I sort of know, like everybody has this general idea how it works, but how do you look at that? Do you look at it like sort of EGFR in general, or are there specific issues with bispecifics?
I love that there are now drugs available that are bispecific for those patients in which there may be one or more mechanism active in terms of driving the cancer or perhaps in terms of facilitating resistance. So having that therapeutic option available is wonderful. The incidence of drug-related pneumonitis thus far is relatively low. No evidence to suggest a unique mechanism of action in terms of the interstitial lung disease that's attributable to those drugs. But the experience is still new. It'll be accumulating over time. And the hope is that that experience will be collected in a fashion similar to the experience that's been collected for use of the antibody drug conjugate so that the entire oncological community can learn together.
So one more question, and again, to be continued, there's so many things that I'm thinking about right now that we, you know, what I'm really thinking about is because of Dr. Modi's presentation, you know, at ASCO 2 months ago, mm-hmm. all of a sudden you got half of breast cancer potentially eligible for TDXD. So a whole ton of patients, a lot of proactive patients who want information, and this is happening now. You've got these data coming out, so kind of like a perfect storm, I guess, in some ways. But I just want to ask you about antibody drug conjugates in general, because one of the things that we've noted in CME in general is like a lot of positive trials, a lot of approvals. There's, you know, tisotumab vedotin cancer of the cervix, multiple myeloma now is antibody drug conjugate to BCMA, belantamab, antibody drug conjugates now first line, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, polatuzumab. We were talking about bladder cancer. There's sacituzumab, and sacituzumab's in breast cancer as well. I kind of get the feeling like all chemo can cause ILD, that all these things can cause ILD, but like it's kind of different than TDXD. Is that too global of a perspective, or is that kind of the way it is? Like I know like sacituzumab causes some ILD, but is it kind of like not that common and not that huge of a problem?
So whereas we have really, I think, complete data, especially for the early phases of pneumonitis that may be associated with trastuzumab deruxtecan as an antibody drug conjugate, it's not clear that we have the same compendium of complete information available for the other drug conjugates at this point in time. So it's hard to do a direct comparison. But I just also want to comment that not all antibody drug conjugates are the same. And so the ones that I describe, the basic structure is the same. The basic structure being the warhead is the same across the three antibody drug conjugates I talked about, and the linker is the same, and the dose of the toxic dose in terms of the payload is the same across all three of those antibody drug conjugates. What differs is the antibody. But when we talk about some of the other antibody drug conjugates that we were just discussing, the mechanisms and the structure of the conjugates are different. So there can be a different ratio of drug to antibody. There can be a different linker that may or may not be associated with differences in the specificity of delivery of the payload to the cells of interest. And so therefore, I don't think we're going to be able at this point in time to generalize the impact and incidence of ILD across the class of antibody drug conjugates, and that we have to focus on the interstitial lung disease and other toxicities associated with the different subtypes of antibody drug conjugates that are under development or are being released. And And I welcome the opportunity for those data to become widely available for these types of important comparisons that you're talking about.
Although I guess the bottom line, and I asked this to Dr. Modi in a program we did with her recently, you know, again, when you kind of think about it at a macro level, I'm sure, you know, pulmonologists obviously see it in a much more complicated scenario. But I guess the bottom line is there are deaths from ILD with TDXD and other, as you mentioned, other antibody drug conjugates with the same sort of payload. And I guess I'm just assuming there weren't deaths with like sacituzumab and polatuzumab, although I don't know whether they could have been buried in there and missed. I don't know, but I assume that you don't see deaths, and that's why it's not a clinical concern in the same way, but you tell me.
I would say I don't have enough information to give you an answer one way or another on that. But I am aware of what has been reported in terms of the absence of ILD-related deaths. But I can also tell you from the experiences that we have from this adjudication process, there may be cases in which the investigative team was not sure that the death was due to ILD, but whereas a retrospective review of all the information provided sufficient information to confidently determine that, yes, the death was attributable to a drug-related ILD. So you know, therein lies the caveats, and I think we will learn much over time. But I do think it's fair to say that given the experience to date that we are learning about this experience, and it's similar to the experience that we all saw with the checkpoint inhibitors, is that toxicity does occur and it is manageable. And it's especially manageable if it's thought about early, with efforts made to detect it early, to hold off on subsequent administration of the active agent while the interstitial lung disease process is still active. And it's especially manageable if early treatment is initiated. And so I think those important lessons have been learned again. And that learning, I think, has been accelerated and catalyzed by the experience with checkpoint inhibitors. And I'm sure it'll be useful as other classes of drugs are developed that may also be associated with toxicity of the lung and other organs.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Powell, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.